I was thinking, no, they've done this deliberately. They haven't just like emptied a sack of words out and just put them onto a page. They've written the words like this on purpose. Why?
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. Gabriel Badamozzi talks with Antti Anaxagora about his duality and why he describes himself as a British-born Cypriot poet.
The idea of being British-born for me is statement-driven. It's the idea that I was born in Britain, educated in Britain. My perspective, the way that I look at the world, has been shaped by living and being born in Britain. So I think the stamp of being born is kind of why I keep it in the bio, because I could just say a British poet. I don't even have to say British Cypriot, but I think if you feel that your ethnicity, your nationality is contested in some way, the idea of stating the obvious is important. I think if I didn't feel that people question, who are you? Where are you from? Oh, you've got a Greek name. You must be from Greece. And I say, no, I'm Cypriot. Oh, Greek or Turkish? No, I'm Greek-speaking Cypriot. Oh, why do you say speaking? Aren't you from Greece? And you have to go through. So your identity is constantly being poked at. And you're having to qualify so many different parts. Oh, but you were born here. Yeah, I was born here. So I think the reason why I say that is because so many times in my life, I have been made to feel like I've had to explain who I am and why I write the things that I do in the way that I do it. And so I think that's a corollary of that.
Do you experience in Britain a sense of your multiplicity, and how does that multiplicity nestle into what is a global society, certainly in London, but really in Britain post-empire as a whole?
Well, I think a lot of Brits have a reference point for Cyprus. I think I'm fortunate in the sense that when I tell people I'm Cypriot, a lot of people in the UK know where that is, whereas America, they haven't got a clue. I think it's also a reason why my books can't get published in America as well, because people just don't have that reference point for what I'm kind of talking about. But I do feel that there is an affinity, a cultural affinity with Cyprus that the Brits have. And I think that is a product of colonialism, is the fact that the Brits got there in 1878, releasing it from the Ottomans up until 1914, when it was annexed by the British and it became a colony in 1925. And so I feel that having that presence there up until 1960, when it was given independence, has resulted in British people going there on holiday, or, you know, oh yeah, I like halloumi, or whatever it might be. So there is that kinship, perhaps, that I feel a lot more closer to Cyprus in London than what I do if I was in like New York or somewhere like that.
Could I ask you to read one stanza in the title poem of your collection, After the Formalities? This one, which begins after the formalities.
After the formalities, of course I said London, and of course he asked again. When I said Cyprus, he leaned into his chair, recalling a family holiday, the weather sublime, the people accommodating, particularly towards the English, how it was a shame about the Turkish thing, and your parents. When did they enter here? In the late 50s, I replied. So before the Immigrants Act. Yes, I said, before. Well, good for them, he said, putting the lid on his pen, closing his pad, asking me to talk a bit more about my previous roles.
Great, lovely. So here's an encounter with someone English, sort of trying to kind of place you, the way the English do in terms of class, of ethnicity, background. Oh, how do you fit in our kind of complex social hierarchical pattern? And you're pretty clear about it, but he remembers, you know, nice formal holidays in Greece, all very welcoming, nice to us, the English. That's one side of Cyprus. Another side is I met the father of a friend, a soldier, and they said, oh, don't worry about him. He's just kind of feeling bad because his new leg's hurting him. Mm. And I thought, new leg? I couldn't spotted it. He'd had it blown off in Cyprus.
British soldier.
British soldier. Mm. And also in my school here in South London, this was an area, I'm still here, it's basically Camberwell. This was an area where lots of Cypriots, Greek and Turkish settled. Just up the road is the Greek Orthodox Cathedral, in fact. But into my school came a chap from Famagusta in Cyprus, who'd been bombed out of his house, of his life. And he brought the war.
Yeah.
He brought the war into our school, into my head, into me. So my experience of Cyprus is of that violence, of that internecine fraternal violence. Reading your work, I kind of see glimmers of a still echoing violence, if only, let's say, in the kind of patterns of masculinity that you encountered. Could you speak to us about that?
Both the books, After the Formalities and Heritage Aesthetics, when I read reviews, I think a lot of the critics picked up on the violence of the books, both of them together, and that kind of very traditional man's man masculinity, like the material that was used, the images that were evoked, the kind of aggression, the physicality of a lot of the poems and the ideas that I'm kind of playing with. And I think they're all true to the texture and the nature of the subject. And you're right, like, I grew up in a house that was patriarchal. My dad was aggressive. He was domineering, assertive, violent. And I kind of feel that all of those things were a result of, and one of the arguments of heritage aesthetics is how we can kind of take the violence on a macro scale and bring it home and create a micro version of that, how we reproduce systems of state violence within the home. And if you come from a colonial country, and you would have, although my father doesn't, he was 18 when Turkey invaded, and because he had a British passport, because he was born here. So he was born in Cyprus, but he was a British citizen. He was evacuated straight away. So he didn't really experience the war. But I feel that the kind of psyche, as you're saying, of Cypriots who were born from 1950 to 1970, do have that, and they do carry that. And that became part of the culture. They were a hard people that were hardened by circumstance. And I wanted to really capture that in the poems. And also, I'm not a fan of making poems pretty. I know that there's this argument of the sublime, the transcendental, the kind of aesthetically picturesque, the pastoral, the landscape. I think all that is fine. I enjoy reading those poems. But how this subject sits with me is not pretty. And there is this, and I don't know if it's an English thing, but there is this desire to almost sanitize poetry, to make it neat, to make things and ideas click and have it picturesque and beautiful. And I don't think that's true to what I'm trying to do or to the nature of the stuff that I'm writing about. So having a more transgressive poetry that does make men look like violent predators, but not in a moralizing way, in a way in which, like, perhaps it was survival. You know, it's that contextual thing of perhaps you have to be hard because the world is hard on you. And that's, and I'm not trying to make an argument for that. I'm showing people that is how it is. That's the, it's a bit like social realism. You know, you don't explain, you just show.
Yeah, you're taking what you've inherited, like this exoskeleton, but you're breaking it down, you're flaking it off, you're turning it into different substances. Mm. In order to kind of make a kind of space for yourself to remake yourself. Yeah. In that process of remaking, is it an entirely personal experience, or are you in some way locking into the zeitgeist, what people in our society in 21st century UK are trying to do?
I think that's a great question, and I think there is a lot of remaking, reworking, remolding, recalibrating the self through poetry. I think that's one of art's great functions, is that we can put ourselves and our lived experience in a particular space and we can distort it. And I think that there is a lot of that that goes on. I've said before that I always write from a question. I write from a place of not knowing. I begin everything with a project with just a bunch of questions. I just feel that you create a lot more room, which is exactly kind of why we're having this conversation. It's because there's room in the poems to kind of move. And I think the idea of not necessarily reshaping, but complicating who I am in relation to the world. And some of these, you know, speakers in the poems, they're not me. They're composites. I think that they're made up of people that I've met or imaginary symbols of who people of colour, ethnic minorities, who these people represent within a diaspora, but also within, as you say, Western imperialism. And just because we don't, and when you say Western imperialism, people think it's a 20th century kind of, you know, academic term that was used to oppose Russia. You know, the West, when did the West? The West was a term that was used to oppose Russia in the Cold War. That's how it formed. And I kind of think it's, people still think it's relational to that. But I kind of feel that when you go to these countries, post-colonial, and you see, I mean, Britain has still got two army bases in Cyprus. 2-3% of the island is British sovereignty. And that's what they're using to assist the Israelis now in Gaza. They're using those two British bases for that. And I kind of feel that that's not post-colonial.
Hmm.
If you've still got two army bases on a land, plus half that land is split, 40% is, you know, accountable to Turkey. It's a de facto state, which is in the north. How the hell is any of that, you know, like, autonomous? There's so many different people in Cyprus still. And so I kind of feel that the window dressing that we give these things is kind of irrelevant when you look at actually what's happening there. And that's why I feel these poems should be knotty and twisted and complex and interwoven, because that's exactly what the thing is. And when, you know, I've heard criticisms of the books and the poems that they're like word salads, or it's too restless, the images can't keep still, he doesn't know how to control an idea, how to unravel and slowly excavate. I'm not trying to do that. I don't want to do that. Like, I do things the way that I do them, deliberately.
Write that poem, which is a composite of all your critics. Yeah. We would love it. My parents are both immigrants to this country in the 50s. Your parents slightly later, but here we are, second generation. Would you say you feel at home in Britain?
Yeah, I mean, I feel more at home. And I think home is a feeling. What did Baldwin call home a condition? And I kind of feel that home is a feeling. It's not necessarily a material, your physical experience. It's more one of, where do you feel you belong? And people always use the word feel when they think of home. Where do you feel you belong? Which is bodily. And I think that London, for me, not so much England, but definitely London. I understand London. I know Londoners. I am one. I can see myself in them. They can see themselves in me. When I go to other parts of the UK, it's different. Like, people carry themselves different. People look different. People dress different. Same in Cyprus. When I go to Cyprus, they know straight away that I'm a Charlie. which is what they call British Cypriots. It's the derogatory term for a British Cypriot.
I tell you, it's the way you walk.
Yeah, for sure. And they, you know, and in fact, they know so much, they talk to me in English. So they don't, I mean, some of them think that I'm Arabic. Like, I've got, like, you know, Algerian, Tunisian. And when I reply back in Cypriot, they're like, oh, you're Cypriot. And I was like, yeah. And then they go, you know, what, we're here. And then they get confused. And I think that what you're saying about this idea of whiteness and assimilation into whiteness, I think Cypriots are still very much, I think the kind of jury's still out. I think that you could ask 10 Cypriots, are you white? And get 10 different answers, which has kind of been the fascination my whole life. And it all depends on how, Greeks is very different. Greeks are very much established because, obviously, don't forget, you know, the Enlightenment,
appropriated.
They appropriated Greek thought and they made it Western. They took it. They literally nicked it. They became obsessed with the classics, and they made it white. Yeah, they made Greeks white. I mean, and Mary Beard often talks about this idea that the Greeks didn't regard themselves as white. Herodotus, by his own admission, called them of intermediate caste. So whiteness, as we understand it today, didn't exist 2,000 years ago.
No, it's so, only about 500 years
ago. Exactly. And it was pioneered and codified by the philosophers of the Enlightenment. And so I kind of feel that Cypriots, I mean, I've done so much reading on history, and up until 1950s, so Ronald Storrs, who was one of the governors on the island in the early 20th century, he famously said, "I understand a white gentleman and I understand a black gentleman." And then he puts, "although I wouldn't let him touch me. But these betwixts and betweens, I don't want to understand." So it was very clear that when the British saw us, they didn't know whether we were white or black or whatever. I mean, they did actually think we were black. There are writings where they called us black. There are writings where they called us Greek. Mm-hmm. And it was the British desire to move the island away from Muslim Ottoman influence into a more Western Christian. And because the people that the first governors of the island, Lord Kimberley, who was the first governor, was a classicist, he himself was obsessed with Greece. And so his kind of desire to Greekify, Hellenify the island became the thing. He wanted to try and convince Greek Cypriots that they weren't in fact Cypriot, that they were Greek or descendants of the Mycenaeans or whoever it might have been.
There are moments when you kind of, you seize on things in Britain and you speak to them. And it's that feeling I want to talk to. And to get us there, could I ask you to read another extract?
Yes.
And I say extract because as I was rereading only this morning after the formalities, I kind of thought there's not one whole poem because one whole poem is so many different spaces and places.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm asking you to extract this fragment. It's from Here the Camera Crew.
Yes.
Right? It's the very last stanza.
Okay. Across the flyover, a tower crammed with hurt, it knew into a flame. Politicians pick sound bites from out their crooked teeth, squinting at the brightness of a screen. Our nation, a slow animal, unable to digest any more meat.
There we go. The way you read your own work is very interesting in and of itself.
Yeah.
It makes a different kind of sense. Yeah. But I'm going to take that thing, that image, that first image over the flyover tower, crammed with what hurt it knew, into flame. That's Grenfell, and we know that.
Yeah.
And the idea of the politicians picking their teeth, picking over the intestines for the brightness of the screen.
Disgusting.
We already know that. But then you come out with this final image, our nation. And remember, our nation, and not just our city. A slow animal, unable to digest any more meat.
Mm.
That's talking very directly to a sense of being British in Britain at a crucial moment when we saw what was going wrong with us and 72 people being burned to death to do it. And then the nation becomes, as it were, like a snake with coils, unable to digest any more meat. Are we the meat in the entrails of this nation, undigested? Is that the situation of us in Britain?
I think so. It was this the idea. I mean, don't forget, this is pre-pandemic. And so it was the idea with Grenfell. When I wrote that, Grenfell was kind of, it was the big event. And I felt that the country, how it dealt with it, it was disgusting. It was grotesque. It was, you look at why Grenfell happened. You look at the people that made money from the cladding, the contractors, the backhanders, like the whole thing just stunk of corruption. And it was for what? It was human greed. It was this idea that this country has a culture of corruption. And we see it in our politicians. We see people who are being paid to kind of, you know, lobby for particular groups. Like, it's disgusting. And I wanted to create an image that implicated all of us.
Yes.
We're all part of that system. And we all benefit from the system, including myself, which is why I said our nation. And I kind of felt, like you say, this reptile, this animal, bloated, sluggish, inert, because of the fact that it's just consumed so much, it can't even move to fix or to rectify or address because of the fact that it's so, you know, it's overconsumed.
So you feel implicated in the not only post-imperial but the imperial colonial, as well as post-colonial kind
I'm
of
a beneficiary. Yeah, I'm a beneficiary, as we all are. Like, and I think it's ridiculous to not say, I was educated in this country. I went to one of the best schools in this country. Grammar schools, QE Boys in High Barnet. And I got a top class education for free. And I kind of feel that that school itself was, it's still, its ethos was Victorian England. So like going to a school like that, being educated in that way about being English, about being British, and about how the British saw people who weren't British, which was me, and people who weren't white. And I kind of feel that all of these things informed and helped me reckon with what it meant to be an immigrant or second generation.
How possible do you feel in that context it is to be a British writer and keep your integrity, to keep your ability to speak truth to yourself and your society? Doesn't that complicate things a bit?
For sure. And I think that's why I think every time I've sat to try and write a novel or any other form of language-based art, I always go back to poetry, because I feel that poetry for me is the best vehicle to contain complexity. Because it is complex. I can't whittle things down. I can't reduce it to a simple binary. Like, it isn't that for me. Everything within my lived experience and within the way I see the world contains layers. And one of the things that I find challenging is, how do I create a poetry that has elements to all of those layers, that can speak, even if it's not wholly, even if it can point or dash or slip or slide around all of the elements and all the layers that I can see? That for me is a more interesting tapestry than just being able to say, like, this person did this, this was bad, and this is what happened.
Also, in your work as somebody who kind of supports quite widely new poetries, diverse poetries, you've created a publication, Outspoken, and you've also created Outspoken as a live event. Mm-hmm. So obviously both of these things, the print and the person speaking, are alive in your practice. Can you reflect for us briefly on those two elements of Outspoken, the live performance that you curate and the publication?
Yeah, so the live night started in 2012. And you know, in short, it was just me getting quite frustrated at the fact that everywhere that I was going, I was being booked to feature. And I was being put on at like 10, 10:30 at night after like 35 spoken word acts. And by the time I was going to read, there was no one there. Whereas they told me to turn up at 7 and I'd sit through 3 hours of open mic. And then the moment I would get up, everyone was completely battered, drained, or just gone home. And I was just like, man.
Life of a poet.
Yeah, like, this isn't that great to feature anymore. Yeah. I used to think it was brilliant. And then you get to a point where you're like, I'm literally just going to read my poems to the host. And I remember just coming back from one of the gigs one night, walking up. I was still living at my parents. I was walking up High Barnet tube station. And I remember thinking, man, what if we just had a night that just didn't have an open mic? How radical would that be? Because everywhere that existed in London, there was a lot of nights, all had open mic. So I just had this idea to have 3 poets, 2 musicians, and no open mic. And I thought, I'm not really being bad, because there's so, everything has an open mic. So I'm not like I'm taking anything away that's necessary. There's,
you're just adding something that's kind of angled differently.
Yeah, I thought there's an abundance of open mic nights. So just exactly that, create something that feels a bit more distilled, a bit more curated, and see what happens. And that, you know, it took off from the beginning. And the press came in 2015.
And what did the press bring? What was that adding?
I think the press for me was, so I was friends with a lot of poets at the time who I'm not friends with anymore, but that's kind of how it goes. Who
I won't ask you any more about that, though. Everyone's hanging on every word. Beef with poets, beef, you're with kidding poets, us. Yeah, yeah. We thought that was rap stars.
No. It's poets have it too, over line breaks and metaphors. I was friends with a lot of those guys, and it was difficult for them to get published. And we knew that it was the fact that they were people of colour, spoken word poets, you know, working class, people just like me. I couldn't get published either. I'd sent stuff out to magazines, I was getting nothing. And so it got to a point where I was like, we've got the live night, why don't we just set up a press? Because I used to think their poems were amazing. I used to think the poems were brilliant. Like, these need to be out there. Why aren't they being... It was only because there was, like, three publishing houses who had a monopoly over the entire country. So I was like, let's just set up our own. And I was already self-publishing because, again, no one would publish. So I was self-publishing. I had a printer. I had a designer. I had a proofreader. I was like, let's just do it.
Have proofreader will travel.
Yeah, the proofreader who would move over. And so that was it. I just kind of set it up off the back of that. And it was done in a way that I wanted to address the monochromatic discrepancy that consumed British poetry, and the fact that it was all white people, predominantly men, writing quite pastoral landscape poetry, traditional English poetry. That didn't really, and this was before the conversations around diversity and inclusion and all the rest of it. So I think that added, and that kind of landed the same time as like The Good Immigrant came out, which sparked the whole conversation around inclusion and diversity. And that was a seismic shift within culture and the cultural discourse within this country.
And how do you feel not only it, but the whole landscape of English poetry has changed in the last 10 years?
It has, yeah. I don't know. I have quite strong opinions about if it's, you know, where are we going and where have we gone as a culture. I think it's more atomized than ever. I think that from my kind of observations, British poetry is largely still very conservative. It fears experimentalism. I think it fears risk. It fears poetry that doesn't seem to embrace the lyric, or the traditional lyric in a way that is kind of familiar, poetry that complicates what it means to be an I in any space. And it kind of just, like, for me, it feels kind of guided. That I'm talking about the books that I see, you know, receive high acclaim. And it's not that we've lost that critical element to poetry. I think that what's happened is that publishing culture has rewarded a kind of poetry that is very safe, that is very English, that a lot of the time is, you know, confessional, if we can say that. And I think that we've forgotten how to hold space for poets who write in more broader ways. Not derivative poetry, but just broader poetry, you know, like taking a situation and making it big. And they do it in America, which is why you see what's really interesting is that there is an appetite for it here, but we just don't reward it. Because if you think about last year, for instance, the Forward Prize, the T.S. Eliot Prizes, it was Americans who won it. And they were buy-ins. They were bought books that were just bought from the States straight over and published into the British market. And so there is an appetite. And we do have poets in this country who are adjacent to Peter Gizzi or Victoria Chang.
And somehow you're saying that we here in this country have not entirely overcome our own conservatism.
Yeah, and I mean conservative in the sense where we want things explained and guided. I mean conservative from an aesthetic perspective, from the fact that work that is more challenging or more dense or more complex is kind of left, and it's the poetry that is kind of pandering, I feel, sometimes for just an emotional response. And I've said that before, and people think, oh, this heartless bastard, he just wants poems that just no one gets.
The basis of our inclusion now begins to be, oh,
yes,
yeah, we recognize you. Oh, Cypriot, oh, come along. Yeah. Oh, yes, you, but come in. And you have to perform somehow that monkey dance for them. Do you feel that pressure to perform your Cypriotness, your difference?
I'm still convinced the English don't really know what Cypriot means. I mean, they'll still think, is he white? Is he not white? Is he European? Is he not European? Does he speak Greek? What is he, Christian? Like, what kind of Christianity? There's still so much ambiguity around the Cypriot.
Ignorance and uncertainty, ambiguity.
And what's ironic is that when the British got there, and I've read those books by those very first travel writers and those first politicians and military men who turned up on the island in 1878, they didn't have a clue who we were. And my argument that's been part of my work for the last several years is that we've inherited that confusion. As a culture, that confusion, that desire to shape a people, but then not fully know what you're shaping them into, has now kind of disseminated across an entire cultural psyche. That's why when you ask the same question to 10 Cypriots, you get 10 different answers. Yeah. And so...
So in your case, it's difficult to perform Cypriotness when they don't know what to expect from Cypriotness.
I don't really know what performing it is either. All I know is that the British came there and made a mess in the way that they've done with a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. And so just saying that ruffles feathers.
Yeah.
And people don't like that. Don't call it... You can say the British Empire because that feels like an abstraction, but don't say British people because it feels like you're aiming it at me. And I didn't do anything because I wasn't even alive then. It's a bit like when you say white people and then you have to qualify. But no, not white people, some white people. Not all white people, some white people. And I kind of feel that it's that fragility, that defensiveness that makes maybe the kind of poetry that I write less... it makes it less warm, less inviting. I think what's happened is that for 50, 60 years, people of colour have been left out of publishing. Their stories, their voices, their experiences have been deliberately ignored. And what happened was when we had that cultural shift that started in 2015, so 10 years ago now, the clerical positions, the people that are in charge of putting a panel of judges together, people that are in charge of editorial, of commissioning, they are people that would have been largely made aware of that discrepancy and now taken those positions, and now they are trying their utmost hardest to ensure that there is a correction, that everyone is a person of colour now, that everyone, and that's why they give lucrative publishing deals to people that are just not ready. And a person, I mean, it just exposed this the other week. There was a report that was saying that black authors are receiving kind of disproportionate amounts for their debuts. They're not ready to publish, or they're not ready for that kind of advance money. The books don't go anywhere. And then the publishers just say, right, we're not interested in that. So how do you maintain a duty of care to writers over their careers? And that are publishers just responding to the appetite of a market? Are British readers now interested in an Irish Nigerian story? And if so, give me your story, Gabriel, and I will give you $100,000 to publish your story. And then if you publish the story and the numbers don't go the way that the publishers want, what happens?
I get to spend the $100,000. Yeah, I think that's what I say. Yeah. Okay, just to wrap up, I kind of want to wrap up on a note about poetry. Of the many things that you, coming from a family where your father was a hard-working kind of engineer, saying, okay, get a life, make a business, your business became poetry. There must have been something inside you that said, this is the only way I can make my way in this life, in the situation that I find myself. If you tried to kind of put that into a sentence, what it was about poetry that called you, what might that begin to sound like? And it can be a broken, fractured sentence of many parts.
I think it was the uncertainty. I think I used to read poems. I'm an autodidact. I didn't get trained in any institution on how to read or how to write. I kind of worked out as I went along. And I have very vivid memories of being 15, 16 years old, writing poetry that was largely informed by hip-hop and music, because that's what I was listening to. And I think with most poets, music is the first gateway into these things. And then when someone said to me, what you're writing is poetry, I immediately thought Shakespeare and Chaucer. And I was like, it's not, because it doesn't resemble what they write. And then I got obsessed with this. I couldn't stop doing it. I kept writing it and writing it. And there were just reams and reams of these like rap lyrics that were essentially like social commentary. They were anxious, moody, kind of emotional, overwrought outpourings of a kid who was trying to like come to terms with the world that he was about to step into. And I was paying attention, which I think was the positive thing. The language itself was crap. The poems were crap. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just trying to make words rhyme. I couldn't rap either. So that wasn't great. So they were kind of just on the page because I tried to rap them and they just weren't very good. And then I remember going into the library, Barnet Library, and just sitting in there because my house was really noisy. There was a lot of people in there and I used to kind of get sensory overload. And I used to go to the library because it was quiet. And I'd sit in there and I'd look at War and Peace and I'd be like, that's a doorstop. I'm not reading that. it's 5,000 pages, forget it. Then I'd see like The Death of a Naturalist that was literally like that big, and I'd be like, ah, I could read that.
Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, I pulled that out, and I was like, this is great. You know, or The Crow by Ted Hughes, and I'd be like, this is great. Like, it's little, I can, and it was the brevity. And then I remember going to it and thinking, what the hell does any of this mean? And it was that invite. At the beginning, I kind of saw it as like, you know, the bars, the gates closed, mate, you're not coming in. But then as I started to stay with it and probe and question, I was thinking, no, they've done this deliberately. They haven't just like emptied a sack of words out and just put them onto a page. They've written the words like this on purpose. Why? And I was working for the poem. And I think that that was my first real enjoyable bit, like a crossword, right? Like that was my first enjoyable experience of trying to find a way in this Heaney poem or this Hughes poem or this Plath poem or whatever it might, whatever was on the bookshelves in those days, in the 90s.
Anglo-Irish, Anglo-American.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it was just the strangeness. It was, why are they writing in such strange, difficult, tricksy ways? And that's what, and I was, what, 18, 17? And that's kind of what pulled me in.
Gabriel Badamosi was talking to Anthony Anaxagoglu. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.